estimated 40% level of support enjoyed in the opinion polls by Boris Johnson and his government. I believe that the Conservatives or Labour would be absolutely over the moon to have the level of support that President Assad has.
When you say that Syrians don't want to take a leap into what is essentially the unknown, what do you think the alternative is? What is the alternative that the West is proposing to President Assad?
The West is always careful not to spell out, any alternative, because they know full well that the only realistic alternative would be a radical Islamist regime. They are totally irresponsible in wishing for what they call euphemistically a transition, which is translated means a regime change, but that phrase has had a lot of bad publicity, so they call it transition. They don't ever say transition to what. And there is no Nelson Mandela waiting in the wings in Syria. In fact, most Syrian people could not put a name on any Syrian opposition leader. I would be hard-pressed myself, and I'm a so-called expert. There are no plausible rivals, alternative political leaders to the president. There are warlords. There are warlords who, like such as those who rule the roost in Idlib, province, who would undoubtedly, after fighting among themselves, inherit the crown in Damascus if the Western powers had their way.
In the early days of Tony Blair's government, the United Kingdom and other countries, they actually seem to be or appear to be on good terms with President al-Assad. I mean, what do you make of the current stance of the last 10 years from those in British politics and media who insist that Syrians are not deciding their own future and who've done this complete 180?
A lot of things have happened since those heady days in the early 2000s when Bashar al-Assad was having tea with Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace and was being seen as the new white hope, and who was moving forward with liberalization of the economy in a way that was applauded in the West. And indeed, it was partly those efforts at liberalization by causing some suffering for the working classes in Syria and privileging of the middle class with this so-called liberalization. This was one of the reasons for the discontent which precipitated the uprising. But things have obviously moved on, and what Britain in particular cannot stomach is the fact that Syria has worked more and more closely with Russia and Iran, and therefore victory for Syria, victory for President Assad would be seen as victory for the leadership of Russia and Iran. This is something that the British government cannot stomach. So you have to see relations with Syria in the context of British relations with Russia and Iran. Poor old Syria is just the victim in the middle.
So just to wrap up, just as a last question, Ambassador, what do you think that al-Assad will do during his next term? What will be the next moves, do you think, from all these various governments that are trying to remove him and topple him? How do you see the rest of the war playing out?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I think one of the options the president must be looking at is whether to make a move on Idlib, now that his hands are less tied than they were, although this is a difficult moment internationally in one way because of the ongoing negotiations between the United States and Iran over nuclear and sanctions, and I can see some argument for not rocking the boat in Syria before that matter is settled. But in due course, I'm quite convinced that the Syrian government will move to repacify the North East. I can see increasing pressure on the U.S. Presence in Northeast Syria. The tribes of that area, the Arab tribes of that area, are mostly very pro Assad. They will not tolerate the Kurdish suzerainty which the American forces are imposing on them. But above all, I think the president will have his work cut out to cope with this continuing economic warfare. There is no doubt that it's the Western sanctions which are the biggest obstacle to Syrian reconstruction, and not just reconstruction, but even getting back a normal, ordinary life with availability of fuel and bread. I'm sure that will be the president's number one priority.
Ambassador Peter Ford, thank you so much for your time, Your Excellency. I'm very grateful for you coming on the program.
Thank you for having me, Richard.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities. This program is broadcast every Sunday by IRIB English Radio.
The countries that have rejected the election results in Syria, dubbing the elections undemocratic, they have been trying to push an agenda and topple the Syrian government now for over 10 years. They have no genuine interest in the will of the Syrian people. They are most concerned with enacting their foreign policy objectives in ensuring profits for their multinational corporations and in expanding their empires. This notion of calling foreign leaders illegitimate or calling elections undemocratic is a tactic often used by the West when talking about countries that they have an imperialist agenda in. We have seen the United States, Britain, and the European Union do the same thing with the Venezuela's presidential elections and its parliamentary elections, which we covered in late 2020 on this program. We have seen the West do the exact same to Evo Morales in Bolivia in late 2019 when he was overthrown by right-wing groups supported by the West. And in the case of Venezuela, this notion of legitimacy has also been used by the Bank of England as a ruse to steal over $1 billion in gold belonging to the Venezuelan people. The West loves to pretend that it has the moral high ground. They speak about Syria, Venezuela, and others as if they are colonies under their rule. This is a colonial mindset. Who are these countries to talk about rejecting the results of the Syrian elections? The results of the Syrian elections are for the Syrian people to decide. And Syrians only, not some men in Whitehall, Washington, D.C., or Paris. I find it incredible that the United States has the gall to lecture other countries about democracy when its own citizens are disenfranchised from voting. African Americans are still treated like second-class citizens, and Native Americans completely removed from any political capacity, wiped out through centuries of genocide. How can the United Kingdom lecture anyone about democracy when its judiciary is controlled by the United States, when it gives immunity to American spies who kill British citizens, or when Julian Assange is rotting away in Belmarsh prison for exposing the war crimes of the US empire? Where is the respect for an independent press and fourth estate? The United States and Britain together have colonized and plundered the world for centuries. To this day, they continue to overthrow the democratically elected governments of Latin America, Central America, the Middle East, Africa, and Asia. They are the last people on earth to be giving lectures about democracy. The fact of the matter is, there has been a cold, calculated attempt to overthrow the Syrian government for decades. We know from General Wesley Clark that a neocon plan for regime change has been put in place during the Bush years, with Syria on the list of targets. We have seen the cables from the U.S. Embassy in Damascus already in 2006 about how best to exploit the weaknesses of Bashar al-Assad in order to destabilize Syria. The United States created al-Qaeda during the Cold War, then with Britain proceeded to help create ISIS through the invasion of Iraq in 2003. With their allies, such as Israel and Turkey, they have provided weapons, logistics, and assistance to terrorist groups inside Syria. And then the media tries to whitewash them as moderate rebels. Since the start of the so-called Arab Spring or uprising in 2011, they have been trying to topple the Syrian government and turn the whole country into another failed puppet state, as they have done to so many others. Through their imperialist greed, they have completely, utterly destroyed Syria. These actors do not have Syria's best interests at heart, nor do they care about the will of the Syrian people. Quite the opposite. What Syrians have done through these elections is reaffirm their sovereignty, cementing their stance against imperialism and against colonialism. The election results are not just a victory for President Assad, they are a victory for the Syrian people. Syrians have shown their resolve and their spirit to be unbreakable. Even after 10 years of war and all the suffering that has come with it, they have been unrelenting. Once again, they are showing the world that they will not allow others to dictate their political, economic, and social affairs. Syrians will not allow foreign-backed terrorists and militias, nor any other governments, to come in and tell them how to run their country. Syrians want a secular, stable Syria under Bashar al-Assad, which stands with the axis of resistance, which stands with Palestinians, which stands against imperialism, and guarantees a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, harmonious and peaceful society for all Syrians. No matter what the media says, no matter how much propaganda they produce and how much they try to sell regime change, Syrians are saying they will not be coerced or bullied into conforming to Western foreign policy objectives. Syrian matters are for Syrians only to decide. If President Bashar al-Assad did not have the support of the Syrian people, he could never have remained in power and withstood 10 years of war against him, and withstood 10 years of the United States, Britain, and Israel, and so many other countries and their terrorist groups trying to get rid of him. No one could. It's unconscionable to think that anyone could survive such a feat without the backing of their own people. Syrians have shown that they support their president and their government, both during wartime and in their elections. For anyone to deny this is simply to deny reality. It's not about one's opinion or what one thinks. This is about understanding the truth on the ground. We also have to look at this election through the lens of resistance. What Syrians do every day, what they have done for years, is resist imperialism through all means necessary. This huge turnout and landslide victory also symbolizes a victory for the axis of resistance as a whole. When we talk about the axis of resistance, we're talking about the nations that the West has tried to break and intimidate, such as Syria, Iran, Palestine, Venezuela, Cuba, Yemen, Lebanon, Iraq, North Korea. We have seen during this vicious war against Syria how the whole world rallied behind the U.S. empire and joined them in their regime change project. Very few stood by Syria's side and remained with the Syrian people. Iran and Russia have helped Syria to stay afloat and to resist this onslaught. When Syria was in its darkest hour and on the verge of falling into the hands of Daesh, they answered the call to aid. They stepped in to provide and help to prevent the unthinkable from happening. They have stood steadfast with the Syrian people, respecting their will and protecting their sovereignty from foreign aggression, both militarily and politically. The entire apparatus of the mainstream media continues to repeat the same lies about Syria in a multitude of languages and mediums. There is complete uniformity and hegemony between the corporate media and the foreign policy objectives of Western governments. Inextricably intertwined, these two institutions work in tandem, and everything they have reported on Syria for the last 10 years has been almost entirely propaganda, and the presidential elections of 2021 are no different. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Answering it down some questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs. Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum. This is your host Haider al-Bahadli from Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Today we have our dear esteemed guest, Sheikh Murtaba Karimi, with us. Sheikh Murtaba Karimi, salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Welcome, Sheikhuna. We have a question from our sisters. The question is as follows. When we leave our houses, we want to look pretty in front of our houses, in front of our husbands. And that's why we put makeup on, wear beautiful clothes, etc., etc. What is the problem with that and with our hijab? We can still have our hijab on and still look pretty with makeup and jewelry and gold and etc., etc. Is that a problem Islamically?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, some of these women who talk about wearing makeup, they may also argue for the same reason that we are not going to put hijab as well, because we want to look pretty in the eyes of our husband. So we want our husband not to look at other women, so we are not going to practice hijab as well. Now, the point is that, wearing makeup and putting makeup, adorning yourself, and wearing nice clothes is highly recommended for the wives inside the house for their husbands. We have very interesting narrations in this regard, referring to the details. Let me just share one narration in this regard. وَعَلَيْهَا أَن تَطَيَّبَ بِأَطْيَبِ طِيبِهَا. Imam says that it is a must, وَعَلَيْهَا, which means that it's highly recommended for the women, for the ladies.
Mm-hmm. For the spouses, for the wives.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
To put the best smelling,
best
perfume.
Perfumes.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
وَتَلْبَسَ أَحْسَنَ ثِيَابَهَا. To wear her best clothes in front of her husband inside the house. وَتَزَيَّنَ بِأَحْسَنَ زِينَتَهَا, to adorn herself with the best, like, jewelry, for example. This is in Wasail al-Shia, volume 14, page 211. So, inside the house, there are many encouragements for the wives to do that. And if really their intention is that their husbands do not look at other women, what they need to do is to do that inside the house. So to claim that we are doing that outside the house so the husbands do not look at other ladies is meaningless. So it doesn't make any difference if you wear makeup outside the house or not. It doesn't make any difference for your husband. If they are not practicing people, they will look at other women because they have seen you inside the house, mm-hmm. and they may be interested in looking at other ladies and other women. The other point is that when you beautify yourself outside the house, your husband comes to this understanding and fact that other men are looking at his wife. Mm-hmm. So why he not look at the wives
of
other men?
Exactly.
This is a reality. I mean, tit for tat, as some people put it. So if really, a faithful woman wants her husband not look at other ladies, she needs to do that inside the house.
Mm-hmm.
So if the husband is sure, she's, unfortunately, many times it doesn't happen. For both men and women, they beautify themselves as soon as they want to go outside, but inside the house, they are wearing the worst possible clothes and
pajamas and normal.
Exactly, and bad smelling. And
not
so
to talk bad about pajamas, but yeah.
Exactly, which mm-hmm. is against the teaching of Islam. So imagine, it's not only about women, of course. Unfortunately, some men, they have this impression that they have no
no obligation or duty in this or regard. Any task to yeah. put themselves in front of
they
their wives.
They smell very bad and exactly. they do not take shower, that's expect the women to come in front of them as an angel and then...
And he looks like a caveman.
Exactly. So the teaching of Islam for both men and women is that they need to do all these actions inside the house to beautify themselves. But of course, it matters most for women. And then if they do that, I mean, logically, the men, they are satisfied, they are satiated, sexually speaking, inside the house. So they have no reason to look at other ladies outside the house. So the logic is baseless, I believe.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
There's another question. And I think we mentioned some of the answer before. I'm going to read it for you. They say that they pretty themselves and foreign men, other than their husbands and close family, they can just not look. Turn the face away, do not look at us, and let us be pretty as we will. This is their argument.
Mm-hmm. Before answering this question, there is, again, a misunderstanding about the concept of hijab and about the concept of looking at non-mahram.
Mm-hmm.
Some men, they have this misunderstanding that hijab is only for the ladies, which is not the case. The hijab is also for the men. There are only, little differences, like covering the hair, for example.
Mm.
So we cannot... claim that hijab needs to be practiced only by women. No, there are Islamic laws and instructions and verdicts for covering and hijab for men as well. So Islam doesn't give a blank check for the men to wear whatever they wish and go outside the house. It's not the case.
Exactly.
There are some limitations that they need to take into consideration. When it comes to looking at non-mahram, again, it's not limited to men. Some women, they have this misunderstanding that not looking at non-mahram is only for men, and they are free to look at all the men.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two points. First of all, if the men, they are not practicing proper hijab,
mm-hmm.
I'm not talking about covering the hair, of course.
Mm-hmm.
As I mentioned, there are some laws specifically for the covering of the men. If the men, they are not practicing, the women are not allowed to look at them. Unfortunately, mm-hmm. some of the ladies, they do not know about the fact that sometimes they also should not look
exactly.
at non-mahram men. Second of all, if the men, they are practicing, they are wearing proper clothes, but the women, they should not look at non-mahram with bad intention.
Mm-hmm.
The same we have it for men.
Yeah.
I mean, if non-mahram women, they are not wearing proper clothes, men should not look. But even if they are wearing proper clothes...
They should still not look with improper
intention. Yeah. So my point is that both covering is for both men and women. The laws for look are also for both men and women. And thirdly, the other point, let me also share that point as well. It is also mentioned by the scholars of especially morality and spirituality that, and also the scholars of fiqh and jurisprudence based on the narrations that, although if, for example, there are women practicing hijab and the man doesn't have a bad intention, still it's better for them to abandon unnecessary looks. The
mm-hmm.
same is true about women.
Mm-hmm.
So the men are wearing proper clothes, and the woman does not have a bad intention. Still, they are encouraged, morally speaking, to abandon unnecessary looks. Because at the end of the day, it will
affect your subconscious.
Exactly, bring about some negative consequences. For example, after some while, if you are a married woman, you may compare this man with your husband, for example.
Naturally.
Yeah, there are some negative consequences. So, let me just share two verses in this regard. The verse which talk about the fact that the believers should lower their gaze and, protect their private parts, is mentioned in chapter An-Nur, verse 30. قُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنِينَ يَقُضُّوا مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ وَيَحْفَظُوا فُرُوجَهُمْ. O Prophet, tell the believers to lower their gaze and protect their private parts. But the following verse is also addressing women, which, as I mentioned, many women may, do not consider it as important as it is. وَقُلْ لِلْمُؤْمِنَاتِ يَغْضُضْنَ مِنْ أَبْصَارِهِمْ وَيَحْفَظْنَ فُرُوجَهُمْ. O Prophet, tell the faithful women to lower their gaze. What does it mean? As I mentioned, there are two or three possibilities. Either the men are not wearing proper clothes, or, for example, they wear proper clothes, but the intention is bad. And thirdly, morally speaking, again, it's better for them to abandon unnecessary looks. So, going back to the question, why Islam does not ask the men not to look at women so that women can freely go out without covering? The first point is that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has commanded the men not to look at women who are not practicing hijab or with bad intention. So the command is there. There are some very interesting narrations about looks. It's both for men and women, but more emphasis is put for men. Like, for example, the famous narration from Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family, that an-nazaru sahmun masmumun min sahami Iblis. Iblis, the great Satan, he has some arrows, so to speak, literally translating. Haram look is one of the poisonous arrows of the Satan. The Harun Anwar, volume 104, page 38. And some narrations about the importance of lowering your gaze or looking at other scenes when it comes to, watching a lady not practicing hijab, for example. There are some narrations that, for example, if a man passes by a lady,
he will be granted great reward.
Yeah.
If he doesn't look at a lady.
Yeah, and look at the sky or lower the gaze. According to some narrations, we have this concept that Allah will give him a kind of faith that he will taste the sweetness of. This is very important. Important because many of the believers, they are believers, but they are not happy with that.
They don't feel the satisfaction and sweetness of belief.
They do not, for example, recite the Quran, but unfortunately, many of us, we do not taste that happiness that the greatest
the joy of reciting exactly the Quran would become tired. Enjoy.
Yeah, and we wish that many actions were allowed so we could practice them. So to feel and to taste that sweetness of Iman is a great level. And according to some narrations, this
is only achieved by lowering the gaze.
Not only. This is one of the ways. According to these narrations, one of the ways is for the men and for women. We have narrations for both to lower their gaze when it comes to looking at illegal scenes.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada. It's a very interesting subject. We learned today, dear listeners, that hijab is for both men and women alike. There's no difference. Both are obligated to lower their gaze when they see a foreign counterpart.
Of course, there are a few remaining points that I think we need to cover in the following session.
If we find time for another program, we will, of course, cover it there. Dear listeners, stay tuned with us for another program. This is your host, Haider al-Bahadli, from Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum. Inna fil jannati nahran laban. إن في الجنة نهرا لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا لبن.
الحسين وحسن حب آل البيت فرض عندنا حب آل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شميحا.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثت لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, I've been sent to complete noble manners.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, you're welcome to For a Better Life with me, Javed Akbari. In this episode, I'm going to discuss ways of treatment of moral deviations. Of course, moral deviations are there, and assuming that you are deviated morally, now what are the solutions and how can we remedy deviation, the problem, the moral problem, and what are the ways through which the moral deviation can be treated? So, as I discussed in one of the previous episodes, we have two kinds of morality, individual morality and social morality. The moral virtues and vice can be concerned with both the social and individual aspects of our lives. Morality is indeed the bedrock in sustaining society. The maintenance of morality is the responsibility of all members of the society. Everyone living in the society is supposed to maintain morality, to observe moral laws, and to stick to moral values. And of course, morality means the observance of the principles of right and wrong conduct. Now, the erosion of moral values will cause degradation, degeneration, and more importantly, the erosion of social values. So, a society without moral responsibility would be even worse than anarchy. Society without moral value is bound to collapse. And some of the effects of immorality, to be brief, of course, are insecurity, insecurity of lives, insecurity of properties. And some of the effects of immorality is injustice, dishonesty, telling lies, hypocrisy, slandering, deception, and cheating in its various forms when dealing with others. Hypocrisy, envy, and jealousy are moral diseases, and a moral disease must be healed by a moral remedy. A disease permeates the entire environment, as a result of which the society and people are affected negatively. In our modern day life, we have a lot of evil, we have a lot of vices spreading in the society. Like, for example, the rate of divorce is increasing, there are abortions, there is robbery, there is theft, killings and moral corruptions are there. And these are symptoms of moral sickness that destroys the community of human beings. No matter what those sickness and ailments are, they have to be curtailed, they have to be controlled and cured. Now let's just get into some detail about moral virtues and ways of treating moral vices. There is no doubt that ethical problems do exist in every society, as I said. Whether a person lives in the society or all by himself, in the individual level or at the social level, moral problems and moral degradation is a common problem in some society. Moral deviations do exist, and we should treat those who suffer from moral deviation like a patient. We should consider them as patient. Moral deviation is a kind of disease, a mental disease, that sometimes can lead to physical disease and vice versa. Because if you are morally corrupt, if you suffer from a disease, moral disease, it will have some impact on your physical well-being as well. And the same is true vice versa. If you have a physical problem, a physical disease, then it will have some impact on your mental and moral well-being as well. Sometimes a physical disease leads to mental disease. In the same way, we should take the physical illness seriously. When it comes to treating a disease, we should always consider three principles or three steps in its treatment. Okay? First of all, in order for us to treat a moral disease or any kind of disease, whatever, whether it's moral, mental, or physical disease, there are three steps involved. First of all, the diagnosis of disease. We should understand what kind of disease it is. We should understand its nature, because the diagnosis is very important. Unless we diagnose a disease, we cannot treat it. This is the first step. And then the second step comes. The second step involves finding the causes of disease, whether it is moral disease or mental disease or physical disease. What are the causes? And of course, once we know the causes and once we know the disease, then the third step comes, ways of treatment of the disease. That's very important. What are some possible ways through which a disease can be treated? A disease can be treated. Of course, when it comes to diagnosing a disease, the physical diseases are easier to diagnose than the spiritual and mental diseases because they have more clear symptoms.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
For example, if someone is coughing, you can easily diagnose that he has caught cold. Or if someone is suffering from backache, you will learn that he is suffering from herniated disc. He has disc protrusion, for example. It is relative to diagnosing such problems because the modern equipment and facilities are there, and we can, through these, through the tools and equipments and facilities, we can easily diagnose those physical diseases. But when it comes to moral cases, moral diseases, moral deviation, it's very complicated. It's very difficult to diagnose the cause, and first of all the disease, and then the causes, and then ways to treat. They involve complex procedures because moral deviations often have similar manifestations and symptoms, and there are some manifestations which are caused by, let's say, by a mixture of several more diseases, and their diagnosis becomes difficult. According to the scholars of ethics or the scholars of akhlaq and physicians, of course, we should carefully and patiently treat these diseases. And of course, the moral diseases have their own procedures, but they involve, definitely they involve, the three steps. The first step was to diagnose the disease, and then the second step is to find the causes, and then the third step was to find ways to treat the disease. These three steps have to be there in order for us to treat a disease, whether that disease is mental or physical or moral. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So I need. So I need. All I need.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hussain Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. Thank you for joining us here today. As you know, we've been examining the meaning of justice and wisdom as two of God's attributes which have been mentioned in the religious texts, such as the Quran and the prophetic traditions, and the traditions of our infallible imams, alayhim assalam. If you remember, we said that wisdom refers to the fact that a certain action is performed in the best way, in such a way that the action or the thing created is strong, is fortified, is very difficult to become corrupted and be destroyed. Justice, if you remember, we said means to place something in the proper place that's suitable to it, to do something at the proper time that's suitable to it, in such a way that's suitable to it. These were the two meanings of these two attributes. As you can see, these two are attributes of God's actions when we use them to refer to God, or we predicate them for God. The question that you want to ask is this. What is the connection between these two attributes, these two characteristics? Is there any connection between them? If so, what is the connection between them? And then, obviously, if there is no connection to them, why is it that we have been talking about these together as basically one attribute of God? The answer to this question is this. that there is a connection between these two. There is a necessary connection between them, and it is for this reason that we've been talking about them. And if our esteemed listeners refer to some of the books of Islamic theology, they can see that usually these two attributes are mentioned together and alongside one another by our scholars. In order to explain this further, let's turn once again to the meaning of these two attributes and see how they're connected to one another. We said that an action is just if it's performed in the way that's suitable to it, if everything that is suitable to it is given to it. At the same time, an action is wise if it's strong, if it's fortified, if it's not easily corruptible, it's not capable of being destroyed so easily. Just by glancing at the meaning of these two terms, we can understand that there is a necessary connection between them. If something is created in such a way that's suitable to it, obviously it's going to last, it's not going to be capable of easily being destroyed. Like, for example, if let's say that you plant a flower in your garden, let's illustrate this by way of an example. Let's say that you plant a rose in your garden and that you give to the rose everything that it needs in order to survive. You give it water, you make sure you plant it in a place where it gets a sufficient amount of light, right? That you place it in a place where wind doesn't affect it, cold winds don't affect it, right? Obviously, if you do it in this way, you take care of it in this way, you're being just because you're doing everything that's necessary and suitable for this rose. Obviously, if you do this, this rose is going to blossom in a very beautiful and refined manner, and it's going to last. Right? So it's not only is this action just, but it's also wise. It's not only is this action an instance of adl and justice, it's an instance of wisdom. This is the reason why we say that God's creation is wise, and it's also just, and these two necessitate one another, because he's given everything that his creation needs. And for this reason, his creation lasts, and it's the best form of creation, and it's not easily destructible. Thank you for joining us here today. We were examining the meaning of justice and wisdom and their connection with one another. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussain Aga, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
The presence of different scholars from IRIB English Radio.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is Viewpoints, an analysis on the thoughts and speeches of Imam Khamenei, the Supreme Leader of Islamic Republic of Iran. I'm Ata, the host of this program. With me in the studio are two guest speakers, Brother Ali Alavian and Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, both from the Islamic House of Qom. Brother Ali, assalamu alaikum, brother, and welcome to the show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank you very much for inviting me.
You're welcome. And Sayyid Mohsen Naghvi, assalamu alaikum, brother.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thanks for inviting.
So, June 18th, 2021 is the day that the presidential election is going to be held in Islamic Republic of Iran. And what is interesting is that in the Islamic Republic of Iran, the term republic refers to the role of the people in their own fate. One of the things which is very important in establishing the fate of the people in this country is voting for the president. And the interesting point about the voting system in Iran and the elections is that every vote is counted. It is in contrast to what's happening in the Western world, like electoral college, you know, votes or something like that, state votes or something like that. Every vote and every person can vote, you know, a person who is that's right.
Eligible.
Mature, eligible, 18 years old, isn't it?
Yeah.
18 years old, we can say can vote. Every 4 years, a new president is going to be elected as the president of Islamic Republic of Iran. The leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, in his latest speech, very much emphasized on this Jumhuriya aspect, or the republic, or the people's role aspect of the elections, and the role that the people have in discerning their own destiny and fate of the future of the Islamic Republic of Iran. Said Mohsen Naqvi, let's start with you, brother, with this voting system in Iran and presidential election. How do you find the role of the people in Iran significant in selecting their own president and then deciding for their own future?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Well, election is one of the most important things that happen every 4 years in Iran. And I want to just refer to a couple of sayings of Imam Khomeini in regards to the election. Generally, obviously, we can see the rituals in Islamic Republic after the revolution, with the sayings of Imam Khomeini or the supreme leader, because they are the main representatives. And I'm being a foreigner.
That's right.
I can see what they say, and practically I do see what is happening. That is all with accordance to what these leaders are saying. Imam Khomeini, in one of his speeches, he mentioned that if people want Islam, independence, freedom, and release from the Eastern or Western bondage, let them all participate in election.
That's right.
This thing is very much colorful. I can see this very much being colorful in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
That's right. And the referendum that was done for Islamic Republic of Iran, the best referendum, more than 98% of the people voted for the Islamic Republic.
So he came after the revolution. He announced that if you give a vote for the Islamic Republic, there will be an Islamic Republic state. If it is not, then I will go, like, I will not deal with you guys. Like,
and the interesting point that Imam saw the people, the crowds, and for sure he knew that he is welcomed by the people, but again,
there's a discussion, like, obviously we need to, complete the hujjah, or the, proof.
That's right.
We need to complete this proof that whether when I'm here, they're welcoming it. Is it because of my turban that I'm wearing, or, being a scholar, or maybe they are the followers of me, or no, they really want this country to be. Because, that crowd that was in front of him, that was the crowd of Tehran only.
That's right.
He wanted to make sure that the whole country wants it. And therefore, there was a referendum, and chose Islamic, state. And therefore, Imam Khomeini named it Islamic Republic of Iran.
That's right.
And because the leader is on the top, then it's upon the people to choose a person as a president in order to manage the country. So as far as it is concerned to the election, I do see people do participate in the elections with the enthusiasm.
Yes.
And obviously they know that it is a responsibility. And some of them do have these comments as well, which I have seen before, that it's a wajib al-shara'i for some of them. It's an obligation. It's a religiously speaking,
yes. That's right.
Why is it so? It's because, when you have chosen a country to be Islamic State, then if there is a chance of selecting a person as a manager for this country, it is an obligation on these people to elect a person who is, we can say, like, who is submissive to the Islamic laws, who can apply the Islamic laws in the countries, and it's upon the people.
Okay.
And if this duty is being left on the shoulders of the people, then obviously, yes, definitely it becomes an obligation.
That's all right. And the people have role in even, I think, selecting the rapper in this country, because we vote for the people of, we can say, Majlis-e Khabregan Rahbari, okay? We vote for them, and it is their duty to select a leader. So I do want to say that it is above the presidential level too. The people's role and this republic aspect of Islamic Republic of Iran has direct role in all the aspects in the high, top, superior levels of Islamic Republic of Iran. Brother Ali, let's get to you. We know that every 4 years, the people in Iran are going to vote for a president, and you know, we have right wing, left wing, we can say the principalist and the reformist, Usulgiran Islam. There are these two different parties in Iran. And you know, and the campaigns in Iran are not like the US or the UK, you know, no extravagance or no much money is spent on that. But the people's participation in the elections has always attracted so many, we can say, foreigners and the media from outside, that the people go and vote for the president and for the future of their country. I think that the media has its own role, and the enemy's media in showing and we can say portraying this kind of participation has role too, whether to show it positive or negative. What's your take on that, brother?
Obviously, election and participation of the people in their own destiny is as a symbol of democracy, and this is the place that people find that they are important and they are playing their own role in right. their own actually fate and destiny, and right. this gives them this right as a human being who has actually the right to make a decision for his own future, for his own government, for his own state. And this has been respected in the course of 40 years after the Islamic Revolution, and people actually participated in more than 40 elections. So it shows, based on even Islamic criteria, that people are actually seen and are respected, and their votes are seen, and they have a right to actually show themselves in society.
That's right.
We have learned all these teachings and principles from Islam, because we have seen even in the life of in the dawn of Islam, when people actually left Imam Ali alayhi salam, while he was Imam, and he was appointed as Imam by God, and the message was transferred by the Holy Prophet in the event of Ghadir. But when Imam saw that the people are not coming towards him, so he led them to be deprived of the blessing of Imamah. So Islam is like this, tells us people should decide and think and come towards the Imam to give him, to actually appoint him as the leader of the Islamic State. So in different countries, different forms of elections, one for referendum, one for the presidential elections and the four parliaments, people actually come to show their participation. The same actually ways have been practiced in Islamic Republic of Iran. But as you explained well, we should not be arrogant of this goodness of our people, Iranians, mm-hmm. because right. they have always been active and actually diligently have been taken part in the elections, and usually the rate of participation was high in comparison to even Western and more democratic countries.
According to the documents, more than 72% in the last presidential election, and the highest dates back to the presidential election of Ayatollah Khamenei, on that time when he was president-elect, more than 83% have participated.
But what I'm going to say is that when we see that good people we have, mm-hmm. so we need to give services to these people in case we actually neglect this important blessing that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala gave us from the side of people.
That's right.
So it's our duty to give them the best services. But
that's right.
unfortunately, due to some discrepancies and shortcomings, I don't know, some statesmen in the country had, it might affect the rate of participation in the elections. But inshallah, we are hoping that this time, again, people see the final goal of this Islamic revolution as the only, let's say, revolution that is supporting the oppressed of the whole world. So
right.
this is the only den that Muslims actually are looking to from different parts of the world.
Right.
So it is now again to make another surprise to the world and to come and select the president with a higher rate of participation.
Of course, you know, the type of democracy that we are talking in Iran is very much different from the democracy we see in the world, in the Western world especially. You know, the new terminology and juxtaposition that is used is democracy dini, which is, you know, I think wrong.